Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 481, titled An Interview with John Buchanan. This is being recorded on October 9th of the year 2004. Recall before we begin our interview with John Buchanan that all of these programs are being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU-FM. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on another URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. The Spitfire website has long written annotated descriptions of these various programs and links all over the place running to a website that was inspired by John Buchanan's work that features the various documents linking the Bush family to Nazi industry online. And also the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is available for download for free on the Spitfire website, as well as a search function and all kinds of other goodies as well. So do not neglect the Spitfire website. Now, my guest in this broadcast is John Buchanan, a very courageous independent journalist from the Northeast. And John is known to this audience as the author of a number of articles that appeared in the New Hampshire Gazette talking about the Bush family's connections to Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. John Buchanan, welcome to our airwaves.
Dave, thank you very much for having me, and I thank you for having me on and giving me a chance to speak to your listeners, because I greatly respect your courage in bringing to the awareness of American people the stuff that you know about that I don't know about. So between the two of us, we ought to be a real threat to George W. Bush tonight.
Well, we'll see what we can do here. Now, you are known to the audience as the author of New Hampshire Gazette articles. We'll touch on those in a minute. John, if you would just briefly outline your background for the members of the audience.
I'm from the Civil War town of Petersburg, Virginia. I come from a military family, and I'm the grandson of a Methodist minister. I've been a journalist and investigative reporter since early 1970, and I've worked in every major media market in the country, most notably New York, Los Angeles, Washington, and Miami. And in addition to being a print journalist, I've been news director of an ABC television station and program director of an ABC News radio station. And all I have ever cared about and all I have ever done for a living is to try to report truth that I think is important to the public debate.
How did you come to be investigating the focal point of the New Hampshire Gazette articles, namely the Bush family's connections to Nazi industry?
The really amazing thing about the story is that I decided after 34 years as a journalist in the late spring of 2003, after living in Miami for almost 7 years, that I actually wanted to become a movie screenwriter and move back to Los Angeles and write movie scripts. And so what actually happened was that at the website takebackthemedia.com, I saw a flash movie entitled Bush is Not a Nazi, So Stop Saying So. And I looked at the flash movie, and it said that the family profited from slave labor at Auschwitz and so on. And quite frankly, my mind couldn't really embrace the fact that it could be true, but I concocted a movie script called Project Clear Vision, having to do with the anthrax letters after the 9/11 attacks, and I tied it back to the Bush Nazi history and I.G. Farben. I submitted the script in the end of August of last year to a very good movie agent in Los Angeles. His name is Brad Rosenfeld at an agency called Preferred Artists. The Tuesday after Labor Day last year, he called me up and said that he and his colleagues had read the script and that I had written a great movie script that they could sell for a lot of money, but there was one problem with it, and that was that I would have to go prove the Nazi past of the Bush family. I took a deep breath and I said to Brad, you know, I have no idea if that's even possible because I found this on a website. I have no idea whether it's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting justification for a movie script. He said, well, unless you can go prove it, I can never even show this script to anyone. People would be terrified and run from it. So I got online and I did my homework very quickly. And I tracked down the fact that the records of the U.S. Office of the Alien Property Custodian, which seized Nazi assets after the U.S. entered the war, was stored at the National Archives Annex in College Park, Maryland. So I got on the phone as a reporter, not as a screenwriter, and I spoke with a woman actually at the Library of Congress whose name was Christine Blackerby. And she told me that not only did the documents exist at the National Archives, but that she had personal direct knowledge of additional documents that existed in the personal papers of W. Averill Harriman, the late former governor of New York State, who was also the infamous peace negotiator during the Vietnam peace negotiations under Nixon. I went 2 weeks later on September 17th to the National Archives, and in 1 8-hour day on September 17th, I was able to find and copy all of the documents that corroborated the seizures of the five Bush-managed Nazi front businesses that were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act, beginning in August of 1942 with Hamburg American Line, the shipping line, and found a proof that Prescott Bush had been a stockholder in and day-to-day management of this web of Nazi front businesses for the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen, who was the steel and coal baron who was Hitler's original patron and whose autobiography was entitled I Paid Hitler.
Right, now this, by the way, is September 17th is of 2003, correct?
2003, correct.
All righty. Now, the subject of the Bush family's involvement with Nazi business is something that's familiar to many members of our audience, but for people that might be new and for purposes of review and overview, I wonder if you could briefly detail the main businesses and how Prescott Bush and his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker, respectively, by the way, the grandfather and great-grandfather of the current seated President of the United States, explain how they relate to them, and also if you could bring Alan Dulles into that mix.
Okay. What happened was George Herbert Walker, for whom Daddy Bush is named, was essentially the Donald Trump of his time. He was a very wealthy businessman from St. Louis who moved to Wall Street in the early 1920s. And he met W. Averill Harriman, and they became partners. George Herbert Walker had G.H. Walker and Company on Wall Street, and W. A. Harriman had Harriman Investment Corp.
By the way,
they became partners, and in 1923, they on an introduction by the Warburgs, by the way, Max and Paul Warburg, who were other major industrial forces in the Nazi war machine. The Warburgs set up a meeting in Berlin in 1923, and George Herbert Walker and Averill Harriman went to Berlin and met with Fritz Thyssen, who had already decided to back Hitler and had made his first financial contribution to Hitler to build the Nazi Party. Apparently, from the limited historical record that exists, Fritz Thyssen had already decided to hedge his bets. He was the wealthiest man in Germany, and along with another man named Friedrich Flick, who also had significant industrial interests, they ultimately formed what was called the German Steel Trust and built, by and large, the entire Nazi war machine. In late 1923, in that meeting in Berlin, Fritz Thyssen asked Walker and Harriman to form a financial entity in New York City that would handle all of his operations outside of Germany. It was called Union Banking Corporation, which came to be known as UBC. And UBC was really not a bank. It was a money laundering organization for a web of Nazi front businesses that included more than a dozen businesses, but the primary ones, all of which were operated out of the same small suite of offices at 39 Broadway, which Walker and then 2 years later, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current president, managed, along with Roland Harriman, who was the younger brother of W. Averill Harriman, were a Union Banking Corporation, another investment company called Holland American Trading Corp., another business called Seamless Steel and Equipment Corp., a shipping line called Hamburg American Line, and the most notorious and the most criminal was Silesian American Corp., which is the company that used slave labor in Auschwitz, from Auschwitz after the U.S. entered the war and after the Holocaust began. And the name Silesian American comes from the coal fields of Upper Silesia in Poland, which is where Auschwitz was ultimately located. All five of those businesses, beginning in August of 1942, were seized by the U.S. government under the Trading with the Enemy Act. The mechanism that caused the seizures to begin was an infamous article on July 30th of 1942 in the New York Herald Tribune. It was on the front page of the New York Herald Tribune and also ran the same day in the Washington Post. And the headline in the Herald Tribune was, "Hitler's Angel has $3 million in U.S. Bank." There was a photograph of Fritz Thiessen, and the story reported the fact that Union Banking Corp. existed and that Fritz Thiessen, according to reliable sources, was laundering money for Hitler, Goebbels, Goering, and a few other top Nazis. What's interesting about the article, which I have in my possession with the documents I found at the archives, is the fact that it references that politically prominent families were suspected in the dealings, but it does not name the Bush family, the Walker family, or the Harriman family. And that turned out to be very significant in the fact that what ensued was a 70-year cover-up. But as a direct result of that article in the Herald Tribune on July 30th of 1942, the government swung into action, and 3 weeks later on August 26th, Hamburg American Line was seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And then on October 20th, two more businesses were seized. On October 20th, Union Banking Corp. was seized. A week later, on October 27th, Seamless Steel and Equipment and Holland American Trading Corp. were seized. And on November 17th, Silesian American was seized.
Just one point I wanted to interject really briefly. By the way, the Harrimans were prominent American industrialists. They dated back to, I believe it was E. Roland Harriman, who was one of the robber barons who developed his fortune making, investing in American railroads. John, one of the people who figured very prominently in the development of the U.S. intelligence community, and he had his fingers very much sunk into this Nazi American industrial and financial pie. That's a fellow named Alan Dulles. Tell us how he relates to these Bush Nazi businesses that you talked about.
They are very, very significant to the story. Alan Dulles was an operative of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which ultimately became the CIA. And as history would have it, Alan Dulles ended up as the station chief in Berlin when the Third Reich fell. Even more significantly, his brother, John Foster Dulles, who went on to become Secretary of State, was the U.S. attorney for I.G. Farben and other significant Nazi interests and represented informally Fritz Thiessen's interests at a very famous New York law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell on the domestic side under John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles in Berlin largely destroyed the documents that would fully document this story and would have led to the trial for treason of Walker Bush and the Harrimans. Alan Dulles befriended and became de facto intelligence partners with a Nazi war criminal named Reinhard Gehlen, who I'm sure many of your listeners are also familiar with. For 50 years, the CIA has denied the fact that Reinhard Gehlen was in fact the creator of the CIA and that the CIA was largely created with Nazi war criminals, including Klaus Barbie, who the Office of Strategic Services under Alan Dulles helped smuggle out of Germany. 2 weeks ago, UPI ran a story worldwide that in response to a court case, the CIA has finally admitted after 50 years that Reinhard Gehlen played a significant role in the founding of the CIA. And so not only were the Walkers, Harrimans, and Prescott Bush guilty of treason, but they were in effect guilty of subversion of the American government by smuggling Nazi war criminals into the U.S. The other piece of the Nazi war criminal puzzle, which I'm sure many of your listeners and you are intimately familiar with, is Operation Paperclip. The U.S. didn't even take a breath after the end of World War II and immediately decided that our former ally, the Soviet Union, was now our enemy and that we had communism to fear, which became the genesis of the Cold War. Using that mentality as an excuse, the U.S. government and the CIA created Operation Paperclip, which brought in many prominent Nazi scientists to create our defense program and our missile program, which became the missile program that built the nuclear weapons program for the Cold War.
Yes, indeed.
Including Wernher von Braun.
Wernher von Braun was actually a major in the SS. He's gone
Correct.
Down as being some kind of a wonderful technocrat, but he was a whole lot more than that. At least if one views SS officers as technocrats, then he was a technocrat, but many feel he was far
Correct.
More than
and,
that.
And there's a very important subtle point there that I think needs to be made, which many of your listeners may be unfamiliar with, which I have seen some documentation on from the archives. And that is that even though we won World War II, the war was so brutal and the carnage was so extreme that the inner sanctum of the U.S. government immediately upon victory in World War II came to the conclusion that we weren't tough enough to withstand the threat of communism. And their justification, believe it or not, if you don't know this, and you probably do, but their justification for bringing in Nazi war criminals secretly into the United States was that they manifested the toughness that we didn't have in our national character. And just as the Bush administration now is putting people into concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay and torturing and murdering people at Abu Ghraib and Bagram prison in Afghanistan, that any extreme activity under the banner of national security can be justified. And I think that's one of the factors from the Bush Nazi story and the era of the end of World War II that is anything but obscure history. It is critically important that the American people understand the dirty laundry in our national closet and that it needs to be aired for us to be able to face what we have become and what we're doing to innocent Iraqi civilians as we speak.
John, I'm going to interject a passage from a book that was written by an author whose work in many ways supplements yours. It's a fellow named Paul Manning, who was one of Murrow's boys in World War II. He wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, about the Nazi flight capital program at the end of World War II. And what I'm going to do is read a short excerpt from the actual minutes which Paul Manning had, the translated minutes of a meeting that took place on August 10th, 1944. SS General Dr. Scheid, S-C-H-E-I-D, acting as a proxy for Martin Bormann, was describing the Nazis' plans for a post-war revival. And now quoting directly from page 25 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, Dr. Scheid also affirmed, "The ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that patents for stainless steel belonged to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National and Tube, etc., was thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern." And here's the part that I found most fascinating. He also cited the Zeiss and Leica companies and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Now, this is the discussion from the minutes for how to revive Nazism after the war, and they say, basically, Dr. Scheid gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Last time I checked, New York wasn't in Germany or Nazi-occupied Europe. John, one of the things I found most startling about your series in the New Hampshire Gazette was not just that you found Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker involved with Nazi business, but you talk in particular about their involvement with individuals and institutions from 1945 to 51 who were moving Nazi money out of Europe in just the fashion that was anticipated there by Dr. Scheid. I wonder if you would develop that further for us.
Absolutely. Now in that case, as I mentioned at the beginning, in the case of the documents that I found September 17th in one day, all I could really claim was that I became the first reporter in U.S. history as John Loftus, author of Secret War Against the Jews and a former U.S. Justice Department Nazi war crimes prosecutor, has acknowledged publicly. I became the first U.S. reporter to ever actually see the documents and then report the story in a so-called reputable U.S. newspaper. But what happened was that I had planned to be there for 3 days, and I had been rained out by a hurricane, and I sat in a hotel on the 18th and 19th of September, so I came home to Miami with that first batch of documents that confirmed the five seizures in 1942. And every good journalist, as you know, or anybody who's good at anything they do, has a certain set of instincts, and I just had this feeling that if I had found that much stuff and come home with 200-odd pages of authenticated copies from the National Archives from one eight-hour day, and I had not been to the Library of Congress yet, as Miss Blackerby had told me, I would find even more stuff, that I should go back to Washington. So I went back on September 29th and 30th and October 1st. And when I went back on September 29th and I went to the Library of Congress on September 29th and then to the archives on September 30th and October 1st. Now, when I went back to the archives, I became the first reporter in history to see the documents that had just been declassified on September 13th. Two weeks before I got there, that the Nazi dealings had continued from 1942 after the first five seizures until 1951 when Fritz Thiessen died in Argentina. The context that needs to be understood about that discovery was that I have in my possession dozens and dozens of pages of documents from the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Treasury Department detailing the extent of the cover-up and the lies that they told regarding the seizures in 1942, the most incredible being Fritz Thiessen's hand-picked man who he sent over from Germany in 1923 to watch over his money in dealing with Walker, Bush, and the Harrimans was named Cornelius Levens. And Cornelius Levens, who was Thiessen's hand-picked guy from 1923 until after the war, denied that he even knew who Thiessen was. Thiessen's bank in Holland, that was the connection on the other end for the money laundering, he denied he even knew who the bank was, had any interest in the bank in Holland, etc. And Bush and Roland Harriman wrote letters and stuff defending Cornelius Levens and that he was innocent and these charges were outrageous and they were only doing business with neutral citizens of Holland. They had no connections to Nazi Germany and all of that. And the FBI and Justice Department issued cease and desist memos that because their assets were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act and that the U.S. had already entered the war, that they were, in fact, guilty of treason. Well, not only did they not cease and desist, but I have documents that prove that after the war, they moved Nazi assets into Switzerland, Brazil, Argentina, Panama, and Chile. And I don't think you have a listener out there who doesn't understand that, especially in the case of Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, we're talking about, you know, dozens of books that were written about how Nazi assets were cloaked in South America even before the end of the war, and that the living two-thirds of the Third Reich that escaped to those countries and were hunted by the Israelis and others for decades to come. So we're talking about collaboration in the greatest crime in human history, and we're talking about culpability in that crime by the grandfather and great-grandfather of the incumbent president of the United States. And to this day, Dave, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the three major television networks will not even look at the documents. And that's something I'd like to talk about as we get into the story, because I would like to implore your listeners to call Bill Keller at the New York Times and to demand that the New York Times get on this story before November 2nd so that the American people have to reckon with the history of this family and to, God willing, see that history is repeating itself. And we're on the verge, if these people are reelected, of seeing a holocaust against the Muslims. And that, to me, is the relevance of my reporting, and that, to me, is the relevance of the history.
Well, there are a great many things that we have to touch on, and we're going to touch on as many of them as we can inside, too, including your new book, a new trove of documents that you've just accessed. We're also going to relate some of the things that have come out of your first effort. However, we're going to do that inside, too. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a linked URL available for download only. Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. All kinds of links, descriptions for the various For the Record programs, article length, annotated descriptions, and links to various websites, including a website with Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, another website inspired directly by the work of John Buchanan that we're going to talk about inside two, and also that the Spitfire website has a search function. We have been speaking with John Buchanan, the author of a forthcoming book and also some New Hampshire Gazette articles that we've used in the past. We're going to be visiting with John in the second side of our program. This concludes, however, side one of For the Record program number 481, interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of 2004. For John Buchanan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.